You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is New York Times best-selling author Joel Rosenberg, whose new novel is The Beirut Protocol. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. For those of you who are Orthodox or conservative and live outside of the land of Israel, also Chag Sameach, a happy and healthy final day of Passover and a Zisen Pesach. For those of you who are Reform or live in Israel or simply don't think it makes sense to observe 8 days for a 7-day festival of matzah, Mazel Tov on the first day after Passover. Which reminds me, it's time to play our annual rendition by Michelle Citrin of her quite wonderful and slightly ridiculous song, 20 Things to Do with Matzah Now That Passover's Over. Only this is an update, actually, that she did a couple of years ago. 20 more things to do with matzah.
Now what am I going to do?
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? You can make some matzah cards and play with your friends, or you could wear a matzah costume for Burning Man. You could make a cover for your iPad or your iPhone. Stuff it in a pillow, it's better than foam. If your table is uneven, you can make a matzah shin. Or you could play a matzah football game and flag it to win. Make a matzah greeting card, a window cover for your car, a slide for your G.I. Joes. Make a matzah fan that blows. Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Go into your garden and spread some matzah mulch, or you can have a matzah contest for the loudest crunch. Make a matzah pyramid like our ancestors did, or you can make a matzah viewer box and watch an eclipse. Crumble up some matzah to make drywall paste, or you can make a matzah backsplash and spruce up your place. Make a micro matzah brew, a palette for your reds and blues. Share it with those in need. There's so many mouths to feed, there's so much to do with all the matzah you have. And you can still eat it, 'cause it never goes bad.
That was Michelle Citrin, a past guest of Two Jewish, with 20 more things you could do with matzah now that Passover's over. My favorite line is the one at the end about matzah. It never goes bad. That is totally true. For one thing, matzah can't go stale since it starts out that way. For another, once it's baked and stuck in a box, it will outlast global warming, asteroids smashing into the Earth, and very likely nuclear explosions. And you can use matzah next year for Pesach if you aren't too particular about your shmura restrictions. You know what it will taste like? Matzah. My favorite discussion about matzah is people who tell me, really, Rabbi, if you put butter and salt on it, it's fine. Of course, that's also true of newspaper, and frankly, the box the matzah comes in, too. In any case, we are now definitely in the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Passover and Shavuot, the 7 weeks that extend from the second night's Seder of Pesach, the great festival of freedom, right up until the night of Shavuot, the holiday of receiving the Torah at Sinai. Each night of this period, we perform a brief ritual, counting the Omer, reminding us of the ways our ancestors brought a special grain offering to the temple in Jerusalem, connecting them especially closely with God during this period. These subsequent 7 weeks create a time for deepening that freedom of Passover through the slow, steady work of self-exploration. Each day, examining the habits of thought and behavior that have kept us enslaved. The setting we'll play of the Sfirat HaOmer includes the introduction to this blessing. This introduction is used by Sephardim and Hasidim, and it reads, "For the sake of the unification of the transcendent creative power with the divine presence dwelling here and now, I am here, I am ready to fulfill the great mitzvah of counting the Omer." This composition is by Shir Yaakov Feit, the performance by Yosef Goldman, Deborah Sachs Mintz, and Chava Mirel singing, Joey Weisenberg on mandolin, Zach Fredman on guitar, he wrote some of the music as well, Daniel Ori on bass, and Megan Weider Gould on violin, the Sfirat HaOmer.
L'shem Yichud Kod Shabrichu Ushchintei Hineni Muchan Umezuman Lekayem Mitzvat Aseh L'shem Yichud Kod Shabrichu Ushchintei Hineni Muchan Umezuman לקיים מצפת עשה של ספירת העומר של ספירת העומר של ספירת העומר של ספירת העומר שבע שבת תמימות תהיינה שבע שבתות תמימות תהיינה Kidshanu Bemitzvotav Vetzivanu Al Sfirat HaOmer Al Sfirat HaOmer Al Sfirat HaOmer Al Sfirat HaOmer Shabbatot Temimot Tiena Sheva Shabbatot Temimot Tiena
was the Sfirat HaOmer for the period of the counting between Passover and Shavuot, the period we're in right now. We'll return on to Jewish in a moment. Our guest, Joel Rosenberg, will tell us just how he predicted 9/11 before it occurred and how his New York Times best-selling Middle East thrillers have stayed ahead of the news curve in the fast-changing and extremely complicated region in which they are set. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring as we continue to open up. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive synagogue in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone during normal times. In these waning days of coronavirus, Tsoris, a small group joins us in person every Friday night and Saturday morning. Just email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or join us every Friday night right on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. The Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, and we'll continue to hold our services with full music, both by virtual experience and in person with our masked and careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available on Zoom and in blended format. You can access those by emailing us, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Many of those classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, are also available in blended formats, some live and some people there on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and of course all of our services live and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Beit Simcha Tucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing synagogue in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Joel C. Rosenberg is the New York Times best-selling author of 16 novels, including the new The Beirut Protocol, a Marcus Riker novel. He has, I don't know how many books you've sold, but 5-6 million? Not bad for a Jewish guy. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish, and thanks for visiting us from Israel.
Well, Rabbi, you're very kind. It's great to be with you, and I hope you've had a wonderful Passover holiday with your family and friends. And, I don't know how to do anything else than write novels to make things up, really. So, I described it when I grew up in the States that I'm one of the few Jewish people in America that didn't get the financial gene, okay? So I'm not your stockbroker, your accountant, your hedge fund manager. Like, I didn't get any of those good skill sets. So I'm a failed political consultant. So So, Rabbi, all I know how to do is make things up. And I tell my journalist friends, listen, you can do fake news. You just have to own it. There's a job for that. Be a novelist.
You know, it's funny. It reminds me of the old joke about the Jewish mother, you know, if her child is a genius, he's a doctor. If he's not quite as smart, he's a lawyer. If he's a little slow, he's an accountant. And if he's useless, he becomes a rabbi. Yeah, I don't know if a novelist is worse than rabbi. I think we're in the same boat.
As long as you're not making things up. I mean, you are still drawing from the Bible. I'm working from whole cloth here.
So in a way you are, and in a way you're not. Often your books feel like they're torn from the pages of the actual news, all the stuff that's really going on right now. But obviously there's a lead time on books. How do you become a Navi? How do you become a prophet and look forward and figure out what story is going to be the hot story by the time the book comes out?
You can't. And to try is to play with dynamite. There's no upside in it. But let me make clear, I'm not a prophet. I'm not a psychic. I'm not a clairvoyant. I'm not a modern Nostradamus. I've been called all of those things. But that's because the novels have had this feeling, this eerie, sometimes bizarre feeling that they are ripped from at least tomorrow's headlines.
Yeah.
I can share with you the first novel I wrote, which really set the stage. If we've got time,
sure,
I'll do that. I'll make it quick, but Nick.
No, you know what I want? I want to hold that because now I want people to come back to find out. We will continue and talk much more with Joel C. Rosenberg. His new book, The Beirut Protocol, is all about, a Saudi treaty with Israel and a lot of other things. We'll learn about that when we come back, and much more, particularly about his first novel here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from TooJewishRadio.com or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the different theories of Jewish history. One of the ways that I teach this when I teach overviews of Jewish history, kind of very broad overviews, is cycles of migration, acceptance, success, persecution, and expulsion. That sequence has taken place many times over the years. Whether that was because Jews became financially successful and therefore were envied, or whether it was because they loaned money to the king, sometimes under forced loans, and then the king didn't want to pay it back, and then instead just took all their possessions and kicked out the Jews. There's many different ways of looking at it, or whether it was because of religious choices, religious persecutions, Islamic fanaticism, Christian fanaticism, take your pick. But that's not necessarily how you look at it.
I certainly don't think that the explanation of all the expulsions, persecutions, mass murders of Jews was due to jealousy regarding their material wealth. They may have been, the non-Jews, whether Muslims or Christians, may have been jealous of other things. There's also, almost since the birth of Christianity, there's been an imperative for various Christians, whether evangelicals or Roman Catholics, or whatever, with the possible exception of Eastern Orthodox Christians, there's been an imperative to convert the Jews. First, it was the Jews killed Christ, therefore they should suffer, but they can't be destroyed because they're the witness people. This was the doctrine of witness of St. Augustine way back in the 4th or 5th century of the Common Era. So this stuff is all very old, and I don't find it as interesting to talk about very ancient history as relatively modern history, which, for the sake of this conversation, we can define relatively modern history as history that began in 1492, discovery of America and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain.
Right.
So one of the consequences of the expulsion of Jews from Spain, and certainly an unintended consequence, you know, the Spanish monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, did not expect this to be the case. When news of the expulsion decree got out, and it got out through the entire Muslim world because it affected Muslims as well as Jews, the Ottoman Sultan at the time, Bayezid, which means thunderbolt, said to his chief vizier, basically his prime minister, he said, "What an idiot this king of Spain must be to get rid of the very people who made him wealthy. Quick, load up boats with really nice clothes and nice food and invite the Jews who were fleeing Spain and looking for a safe haven to come and settle in our territories." So at that time, the second biggest city in the Ottoman Empire was Thessaloniki.
After Constantinople, of course.
Oh, of course. That's why it was second.
Yeah, I got it.
Anyway.
In case somebody doesn't know, you know, it's all right.
Okay. So they did this, and a lot of Jews settled in Thessaloniki until it became a city in which nobody was in the majority. There were Greeks, Turks, Armenians, Albanians, Bulgarians, Jews. Everybody was there, and they were all minorities. But the biggest of all these minorities was the Jews, with 35 or 40%. And they carried on their tradition of speaking in Ladino, which in their language is Espanol. They didn't even distinguish between
Spanish,
regular Spanish
and
this Spanish that's written in Hebrew characters. But because of that movement and because of the attitude of the Ottoman government towards Jews, at least at that period, that they were welcome everywhere and given great rights and fully participatory roles in society, throughout the Balkans, in really small places that you've never heard of, like Foča or Bitola, whatever, there are still remnants of Jewish communities, now very small, but lots of history in terms of synagogues and cemeteries. And they are Ladino-speaking Jews because they came from Spain. Were they thrown out of Spain because they were wealthy? To be explored next week.
Okay. We will come back and do it then. Thanks, Tom.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. And like those boxes of matzo we didn't quite finish, here's a leftover joke from Pesach. A blind man sits on a park bench during Pesach. A rabbi sits down next to him, takes out his lunch, including, of course, some Pesach matzah. Seeing the blind man has nothing to eat and taking pity on him, the rabbi takes a piece of matzah and gives it to the blind man. A couple of minutes later, the blind man turns, taps the rabbi on the shoulder and asks, "Who wrote this garbage?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You see, the blind guy thought the matzah was actually writing in Braille. Never mind. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion, Shmini, third in the book of Leviticus, includes a dramatic and traumatic event. The tabernacle in the wilderness has just been consecrated and the priests, Moses' brother Aaron and his sons, are beginning their service. God's presence fills the tabernacle, and all is right with the people and apparently the world. Then, suddenly, unexpectedly, disaster strikes. Aaron's eldest sons, newly ordained priests named Nadav and Avihu, offer Esh Zarah, strange fire, to the Lord. They are immediately struck down, devoured by divine flame, dying before God. In the aftermath of this tragic shock, Moses consoles Aaron with peculiar words. God says, "By those brought near to me I am consecrated and honored before the people." There is no mention of whether Aaron accepted this as a fair ending for his sons. The text merely says, "Vayidom Aharon." Aaron was silent. We do not know the young priest's offense, if they committed any. We are not told what that strange fire was. God decrees, atonement offerings are made for whatever sin the young men may have committed, and the people are restored to God's favor. There is no further explanation given in the Torah, although the rabbis later create a variety of possible explanations for the disaster. Perhaps the young men were drunk, or they offered sacrifices that weren't ordered by God, or they were actually engaged in some form of idolatry, or too arrogant and simply usurped their father's place making offerings. The truth is, we don't know why Nadav and Avihu died, Aaron's sons. Of course, that's not only true in the Torah. We also don't know why many tragedies take place in our own lives, or why terrible things sometimes happen to good people. As Ben Sirach says in the text Ecclesiasticus from the Apocrypha of the Hebrew Bible, "We have been shown more than we can understand." God keeps God's rationale private. We just don't know, and likely we won't. So, just what do we know? Well, we do know that Aaron's silence may be the only real response to profound tragedy and loss. Our own comfort and consolation may come only when we silently acknowledge our own powerlessness. This provides small comfort indeed, but it is also an honest appraisal of our ability to comprehend profound loss. May God keep all of us from tragedy, but may God also give us the strength of Aaron when we must face it, the ability to accept the painful inadequacy of our own explanations with dignity and courage. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, New York Times bestselling author Joel Rosenberg, will explain how he went from advising first-time Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, who lost for re-election way back then, to writing Middle East thrillers that seem to predict the zeitgeist before it actually occurs. Hear all about it when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Rabbi Gilad Kariv, a past guest of To Jewish and leader of the Reform Movement in Israel, was elected to the new Knesset in the recent Israeli elections. Once sworn in, Kariv will be the first Reform rabbi ever to serve in Knesset. Longtime religious pluralism activist, Kariv has been running in Israeli elections over the span of almost 9 years, but this is the first time he has won. Kariv ran for Knesset on the slate of the Labor Party multiple times in the past, but in party primaries earlier this year, he won the fourth spot on Labor's list in the election just about 2 weeks ago. That meant that if Labor got enough votes to enter Knesset, so would Kariv. According to the nearly complete tally of votes, delayed by coronavirus complications, Labor has won 7 seats, more than enough to earn Gilad Kariv a spot. He plans to advocate for religious pluralism and to work to counter Haredi ultra-Orthodox control over religious affairs in Israel. Labor's new leader, Merav Mikhaeli, is an outspoken advocate for feminism and social equality in Israel. "I'm ready to be more engaged in my other world of social impact, meaning the political work," said Kariv. "For us, the fact that equality isn't a legislated constitutional value in Israel is a disgrace. It's a Jewish disgrace, not only a democratic disgrace." Kariv's election comes amid a small resurgence of left-wing Zionist parties. Labor, Israel's original and long-time governing party, was thought to be completely moribund before Micheli revived it this year. Meretz, historically to Labor's left, is also on track to grow its Knesset delegation. Taken together, the two parties will double the number of seats they hold in the Knesset. While Reform Judaism is the largest Jewish denomination in the United States, of course, it counts only a small percentage of Israeli Jews among its members. Many Israelis are unfamiliar with what the movement believes and practices, and religious policies are generally not at the forefront of Israeli voters' minds when they cast their ballots. This year, the status of Reform Jews in Israel, who are not recognized by the country's Orthodox Rabbanut, the rabbinate — by the way, there are many Orthodox rabbis in Parliament and Knesset — the status of Reform Jews in Israel became a campaign issue this time round. Last month, Israel's Supreme Court ruled that the state must grant citizenship to people who underwent Reform and conservative Jewish conversions performed in Israel, as reported here on Too Jewish. The ruling sparked protests from Haredi Orthodox religious leaders, as well as a stream of derogatory comments about Reform Jews from Haredi politicians and campaign ads mocking them. Even Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu claimed, without evidence, that the ruling will lead to Israel being overrun with fake Jewish converts from Africa. The conversion ruling came while Haredi politicians vowed that they would not work with Kariv in the Knesset or even count him in a minyan when they daven. That is itself a violation of Jewish law. Anyway, in February, a Haredi journalist lamented a photo of Kariv hanging a mezuzah on the doorway of Labor's headquarters. Seems like a good idea to me. Kariv portrayed the attacks as yet one more reason to fight the Haredi monopoly over Israel's religious policies. And now he is in Knesset, perhaps in position to begin to do something about it. As Kariv said, "This is the first time in Israel's Knesset that we'll have direct, clear, unprecedented representation for Reform Judaism. One thing is clear. We have made it into the Knesset. With our messages, our values, we're sounding a Jewish, egalitarian, democratic voice that strives for social justice, loves humanity, and struggles for peace." Of course, this new Knesset has so far shown no clear majority coalition for either major party or any prime minister, and the likelihood of yet another Israeli national election looms in the near future. In America, the struggle over denying voting rights got weirder when Cindy Hyde-Smith, a Republican senator from Mississippi, insisted to Senator Chuck Schumer, who is, of course, Jewish, that in Mississippi, at least, the Sabbath is on Sunday. Last week, the U.S. Senate debated a slate of state-level bills that would limit voting opportunities, understood by all as a Republican effort to suppress Black and Hispanic votes. One bill, backed by Republicans in Georgia, would bar voting on Sunday, a day known nationwide among Black churchgoers as Souls to the Polls, when parishioners head straight from church to polling places. Schumer, the New York Democrat, who is the Senate Majority Leader and the highest-ranking elected Jewish official in U.S. history, was among a number of Democrats who wondered why Georgia Republicans wanted to end the Sunday voting tradition. Hyde-Smith was there to answer, directing her remarks specifically to Schumer. He was wondering why on Sundays Georgia would not participate in an electoral process of gathering signatures, registration, and things. Georgia's a southern state like Mississippi. I cannot speak for Georgia, but I can speak for Mississippi, said Hyde-Smith, on why we would never do that on a Sunday or hold an election on a Sunday. In God's word, in Exodus 20:18, it says, "Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy." So that is my response to Senator Schumer, said Senator Hyde-Smith, who, by the way, attended a segregated private high school and sends her kids to the same place. Anyway, that precise quote is from the Ten Commandments. It reads, "Zachor et Yom HaShabbat LeKodesho," remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Exodus, of course, is part of the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, which Christians often refer to as the Old Testament. That verse refers not to Sunday, but to Saturday, which is when we Jews have always and historically observed the Sabbath, beginning at sundown Friday, ending at sundown Saturday night with Havdalah. So really, Senator Highsmith, if those voting officials in Georgia and your state of Mississippi want to follow the Bible, they should outlaw voting on Saturdays and keep on allowing it on Sundays. Georgia Republicans have not mentioned the religious status of Sunday in explaining their proposal. They argue that because some counties cannot afford to run Sunday voting operations, the practice is inequitable. Georgia Democrats, including Senator John Ossoff, who is Jewish, and Senator Raphael Warnock, a black pastor, say the law is aimed at depressing turnout among black voters, who are key in flipping the state to Democrats in the presidential election of 2020 and in putting Ossoff and Warnock in office. In other news, Sabra, one of America's largest makers of hummus, has recalled 2,100 containers of its 10-ounce classic hummus because of possible salmonella contamination. Listen, if you're eating hummus on Pesach, you probably shouldn't be anyway. The FDA says no consumers have reported complaints so far and noted the containers had a best-before date of April 26th. The containers were recalled from Alabama, our own state of Arizona, Arkansas, California, Florida, Indiana, Mississippi, Maine, Missouri, Nebraska, North Carolina, New Jersey, Utah, Virginia, Washington, and Wisconsin. Sabra has previously recalled batches of hummus for listeria contamination in 2015 and 2016. Look, I have to admit, I don't think Sabra hummus tastes very good, and now I have another reason not to eat it, even after the end of Pesach. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world.
Our brothers, the house of Israel.
We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guests this morning. Joel C. Rosenberg is the author of the new novel, The Beirut Protocol, a Marcus Riker novel, who is a dramatic and dynamic figure through a number of his novels. Joel has written 16 novels, including The Last Jihad, The Last Days, The Ezekiel Option, and many others, and sold about 5 million books, which is only about 4,999,900 more than I've ever sold. So I'm impressed. Tell us about the first novel and how that developed.
Happy to do it, Rabbi. So I told you that I was a failed political consultant. The last person I ever worked for in that type of capacity was then former Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. He had been Prime Minister from 1996 to 1999. He lost his reelection. And in the fall of 2000, he put together a comeback campaign team. I was hired to be part of that, and then he did not come back for 9 more years. So that was one more campaign that I was helping go nowhere. So in January of 2001, I still had my consulting firm. I was licking my wounds from Netanyahu being, you know, sort of checkmated from running at that time. And I said to my wife, listen, since I was a kid, I wanted to write a political thriller. I'm gonna try my hand. And she said, well, you know, don't give up your day job. Like, why don't you write a few chapters and see, you know, if you're, you know, if you're doing, like, you know, you're not, this hasn't been what you've been doing for your life. And, you know, we had 3 young kids. And so, okay. So in January 2001, I sat down and I began to write a novel called The Last Jihad. Jihad, the word in Arabic from the Quran known as the Holy War. Okay, so The Last Jihad, the first page of the book that I begin to write, puts you inside the cockpit of a jet plane that's been hijacked by radical Islamist terrorists, and it's coming in on a kamikaze attack mission into an American city. Now, this is almost 9 months before the horrific events of September 11th, 2001, okay? And there were details in my book that were different. I mean, again, I wasn't predicting it. I was writing a novel. But from that opening, the American president in the book, fictional president, he declares war not only on these radical Islamist terror cells and groups, but he decides that he needs to remove Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq. And that's the narrative arc of The Last Jihad. So I was finishing that novel on the morning of September 11th, 2001, in the townhouse where my wife and kids and I were then living, 15 minutes away from Washington Dulles Airport in Northern Virginia, at the exact moment that Flight 77 was being hijacked from that airport, flown over our house and into the Pentagon. And that's, you know, that's, you know, I wasn't, you know, once I heard that that was happening, of course, I wasn't thinking, oh my gosh, my book is coming true. I was thinking what everybody in America was thinking, which, oh my gosh, our country is under attack. But that was so bizarre to write it. Now, no one had ever written a political thriller that involved Muslims, radical Islamists, hijacking a plane and flying it into an American city. And they certainly hadn't written one that then leads to war with Iraq. So try to imagine yourself as, you know, again, I hope your listeners can set aside for a moment their political views about whether they agreed with that war or didn't. That's, think of it as a novelist. Let's say you were, let's put it in a different context. Let's say it was January of 1941, and you're a young guy thinking, I could write a book. You know, something interesting. What if Imperial Japan decide to punch us in the nose, blindside us, attack us, I don't know, at Guam or Midway, or maybe they got all the way to Pearl Harbor? What if they wanted to take over the Pacific? What would happen next? What if the American president ended up trying to win the war with Imperial Japan by dropping two atomic weapons? And then December 7th, 1941 happens, and you hear on the radio Franklin Delano Roosevelt saying, "This shall be the day that lives in infamy." And you're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not predicting it, but these events are beginning to come to pass. And that's how I got started as a novelist. And so many of the books ever since have had that same sort of feel. And it is difficult to convince people that I'm not trying to predict. I'm not. I'm playing a series of war games in novel form.
You know, certainly... I don't know how else to say it. Obviously, it has that feel of prescience, as though you're looking ahead and you just, you know, are good at this. I think you've found your calling, Joel, I have to tell you. In the latest novel, in the Beirut Protocol, you capitalize on something that I selfishly have to say we've been talking about on Too Jewish for a long time and just kind of began to come to fruition with recent Israeli treaties with the UAA and Bahrain and the kind of Gulf state cozying up to Israel. That's the wrong term probably, but this sort of enemy of my enemy is my ally, and the way Israel has been chatting with Saudi Arabia clandestinely for a while. I think a lot of people aren't aware of that. That's a key part in this new novel. Tell us how you work that in without giving away too much.
It is a part of this novel. What I call the mother of all peace deals in the Middle East would be between Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Right here in Israel, you have the fountainhead of Judaism and of course of Christianity as well, but Saudi Arabia is the fountainhead of Islam, and these are not two great tastes that tasted great together for the last 1,400 years,
right?
And certainly in the last 100 years of Zionism, the modern movement, the Saudis have been some of the leaders, not so much in war against Israel, but certainly promoting anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, being part of the blockades and the boycotts against not just Israel, but against the United States, the oil embargo in 1973 and so forth. So, again, you mentioned timing. So I began to write this series of novels several years ago, one of which called The Jerusalem Assassin, which came out last year.
Right.
That was the beginning where but not of the series, but where I began to introduce the possibility of an Israeli-Saudi peace deal. And the Beirut Protocol continues how might that happen, but also how might Iran and its terror proxies try to blow up such a peace process. But if you dial back the research and writing of that, that goes back several years before the Abraham Accords. I pray that the third Lebanon war that I describe in the Beirut Protocol that erupts in chapter one, with thousands of missiles raining down on Israel, I pray that never happens, that part, but I think it's not entirely far-fetched anymore that the Saudis and the Israelis can make peace. And in fact, just last December, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secretly flew to Saudi Arabia to meet with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, widely known by his initials MBS. So this is actually starting to cook here in this region. But when I started writing this series, it was not even a glimmer in someone's eye.
I actually try to read whatever Arabic, I don't read Arabic, but whatever regional newspapers are available, Arabic newspapers in translation, and there's been very interesting little hints over the last few years. I'm sure you picked up on it, and probably the Israeli press has too, that there's been a definite warming of relations between the Saudis and Israel. In creating these novels, which are really intricate, do you just write, or do you set up like a giant storyboard with all the moving parts, or how do you do it?
For different series, I've done it different ways, Rabbi. Sometimes I'll write a 30 or 40 page outline of kind of where I'm going in a single book, but also making notes of how the narrative will play out over the books ahead. But other times I just take, you know, a yellow legal pad and write down a few notes, and then we get started now. But one of the things that's been happening that, you know, when you start writing a novel, this is for me almost 20 years ago, as we said, you just want your mother to be able to find the book at a bookstore within 100 miles of her house, right?
That's your goal, yeah, of course.
can your mom and dad actually find this thing so it's real to them? So that was what but what's happened with 5 Million Sold and is what's happening is that not only are normal, wonderful, regular people in the United States and two dozen countries around the world reading my books, but world leaders have been reading them as well. And they've been inviting me to come meet with them. President George W. Bush has been reading my series. He's one of the few I haven't met of my readers, but King Abdullah of Jordan has not only read my series, which included ISIS trying to kill him and blow up his palace, mind you. He still invited me and my wife for 5 days to come to Amman and get to know him. And MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, invited me not once but twice to come and spend time with him and get to know him. Now, I'm Jewish on my father's side. I just want to be clear, because I'm not too Jewish, just for your show. You're nice to have me on anyway. I'm actually a Gentile on my mom's side.
Okay.
That's an interesting story in its own right. By faith, I'm actually an evangelical. I believe that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. Now, I say that, controversial that may be on your program, but one, to be honest, but two, because think of how crazy that is, setting aside how that is just enough, you know, for you, but for the head of Saudi Arabia, the future king of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, how does he wrap
American,
his mind
Israeli,
around that? Yeah.
Evangelical Zionist. Yeah, I've got two kids that have served in the Israeli army, one in special forces. So that's insane, but he did it. And I'm actually the first Israeli citizen in history, I'm told, aside from the prime minister and the head of Mossad, that's ever met with the leader of Saudi Arabia. So that has given me some insight. Those meetings and my meetings with other Arab leaders, with Israeli leaders too, American leaders, and that gives me an edge. I didn't look for it, but it has happened. And so I'm also writing political thrillers that have the advantage of me sitting for hours and hours. These are not photo ops. These are sitting with them in their palaces and talking about the main issues in the region for hours. And it's been so fascinating.
Boy, do you like these guys?
The ones that invite me, I like because I see that they're trying to make major reforms. Now, they have made major mistakes as well, and some of them have been accused of some horrendous things.
Well, like MBS, of course, with Khashoggi, stuff
MBS,
like that. MBS,
yeah. We were invited, before the Jamal Khashoggi murder, but the actual arrival was going to be a month after it happened, and so we had to make a decision. Are we going or not going? But we were also told by the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia that we were the first delegation of Christian leaders, because I took a delegation of evangelical leaders from the United States. We were the first Christian leaders in 300 years to be invited to meet with the leadership of Saudi Arabia. And that was so stunning to us. So we decided to go, not knowing exactly what was true or not true at that moment, but we felt that there's not a single church open in Saudi Arabia. There's not a single synagogue open in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. There are enormous human rights issues to be advanced, as well as maybe a peace treaty with Israel. What about dealing with the threat from Iran? And so we felt we needed to talk to this person, because he invited us, and he might be the king for 50 years.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, he's a young man, really.
But it was a difficult choice to make, I will tell you. And it was fascinating. And I've actually got a new nonfiction book coming out in September called Enemies and Allies. That will be the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attack.
Right.
And the book looks at both who are our enemies today in the Middle East, who are our allies, and how do we look at people like MBS and others. And I have, the book will be chock full of sort of exclusive notes and the conversations and observations that we had in these meetings throughout the region with the most interesting and controversial leaders in the region. So some of the material, most of it, I try to factor in as novels. But this case, Enemies and Allies will be a nonfiction book coming out in the fall.
I can't wait to see that. Joe, where can people go to find out more about you and, of course, your books?
Well, they can certainly go to my website, which is joelrosenberg.com. And that's Rosenberg, the Jewish spelling, B-E-R-G, joelrosenberg.com. They can certainly find that on Facebook or on Twitter as well. And, of course, the books are available in Protocol, for example, in hardcover, but also in ebook and audio. You don't even have to read it.
You can just listen to it while you drive.
Driving across Arizona. And,
exactly.
Get it on your phone and have it read to you. I love audio.
I want to thank Joel Rosenberg for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Joel, thank you so much. The Beirut Protocol is a terrific read, as are all of his books. And now I want to look for that nonfiction book coming out in the fall, Enemies and Allies. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rabbi.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Amir Eden, a former Two Jewish maven on Israel, discussing his new Hebrew learning website, Hebrew in Wonderland. Our playout this morning comes from our most ridiculous Passover composition ever. Past guest Sean Altman's They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat. Look, don't learn your Pesach or Jewish history from this song, but enjoy its preposterous and very funny spin on the holiday of freedom and matzah, just concluded or in its last day, depending on which stream of Judaism you follow. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. The year was 1492. Hitler had just invaded Poland. Madonna had just become a Jew. Moses was found on the Potomac. Then he marched.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.